Mexico has slapped tariffs on billions of dollars worth of American goods over the U.S. refusing to allow Mexican trucks on its highways. The Mexican vehicles were supposed to be allowed access under NAFTA. The Secretary of State travels today to the northern city of Monterrey. Jason Bobian, NPR News, Mexico City.
Human Rights Watch claims Israel illegally used white phosphorus artillery shells in heavily populated civilian areas of the Gaza Strip during its recent offensive there. White phosphorus can cause severe burns if it contacts the skin. The advocacy group says the use of white phosphorus is evidence of war crimes. Israel denies that charge and says its military is conducting its own investigation. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Families USA, seeking high-quality, affordable health care for everyone and collecting personal health care stories at familiesusa.org.
Are these people in your carpool?
This is David Inge.
I'm Celeste Quinn.
I'm Scott Simon.
I'm Carl Castle from NPR News.
Whether you're coming or going, you depend on us to keep you company. We depend on you for financial support to make that possible. Give to our member match fund today, and we'll use your dollars on April 15th to challenge others to help make great programs possible on WILL. Go to willpledge.org or call 217-244-9455.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Anderson Foundation, Risk Management Commodities, Lafayette, A-Plus Farms Limited, Pine Village, and Schaumburg Farms, Shinoa. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, both programs come from the Focus Archives, the first from December, the second from this past January. I hope you'll enjoy listening to them. Perhaps this will be the first time for you hearing these programs. In any case, do keep in mind as you listen that this morning, in both hours of Focus 580, we'll not be taking phone calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the life of a man named Granville Stewart, a man who was, in many ways, a quintessential Western figure, but someone that I expect is not that well known outside of Montana, where he lived a lot of his life. He was a cattleman. He was a prospector. He was also, at times, a vigilante. He was someone who, like a lot of people of his time, had a fondness for guns, but he also loved books and reading. He taught himself French and Spanish. Eventually, he became a diplomat. We'll be talking this morning with two historians who've written a biography of Granville Stewart, Clyde Milner and Carol O'Connor. They say that Stewart was a figure with a complex but flawed character who believed the dream and lived the reality of the American West. Their book is titled As Big as the West, The Pioneer Life of Granville Stewart. It's published by the Oxford University Press. So if you'd like to read it, you could head out to the bookstore, to the library, and look for the book. Clyde Milner and Carol O'Connor are professors of history at Arkansas State University and co-editors of the Oxford History of the American West. And they're joining us this morning by phone. Well, Professor Milner, hello.
Hello, yes.
And Professor O'Connor.
I'm here too, yes.
Great. Well, I'm glad to have the both of you with us. I appreciate you giving us some of your time today.
Happy to chat.
Well, just to start out, I know that you mentioned in the introduction to the book that you didn't, at first, you didn't start out to write an entire book about Granville Stewart, but that once you looked at some of the record that he had left behind, things that he had written about his life, something about this man, maybe more than one thing about this man, really grabbed your interest.
Well, the most obvious thing is his two-volume memoir, 40 Years on the Frontier, which is still in print. And Carol and I wrote the introduction to the newest edition that has both volumes in one, you know, volume. And that is a classic of recollection about life in the American West. So I started with an interest in memory and how Westerners construct their own memory about their time and place in the West. And Granville became an obvious figure for us to look at.
I know certainly people in Montana know who this man was because he lived there before Montana was a state.
Oh, yeah.
Why, I wonder, though, isn't he perhaps better known, as well-known, say, as other equally colorful and perhaps iconic figures from this time?
That's an interesting question. Maybe it's because Hollywood's never done a film about Granville, although he's popped up as a figure in some films like The Missouri Breaks, but not using his name. And he didn't live long enough like Wyatt Earp to show up in Hollywood and be a self-promoter and start, claiming that the OK Corral was a bigger deal than it might have been. And then there's just that whole, the story of Billy the Kid is also amazing because he dies so young, and yet the fame and celebrity machinery of that time, with Pat Garrett publishing a memoir of Billy, just takes off. And it may be, he lived too full a life. I think the popularity of some of these iconic Western figures is that they die, and they die dramatically. So if you have Billy the Kid or George Custer, you get that dramatic death. But there are others. Buffalo Bill Cody is big and complex and important, and we certainly know about him. He has international implications. But I guess it's our good fortune that maybe we get to allow people to now discover Granville Stewart. Mm-hmm. We'll see if he becomes better known because of our book.
Well, let me ask you this question, and maybe each of you can take a piece of this. I think that one of the things that really makes him interesting is that he embodies these qualities that we think of as being a man of the West. And he also, though, challenges them, presents us with something that's sort of contrary. And maybe each of you, and maybe I'll ask maybe Professor O'Connor can take a piece, and each of you can kind of give me an example of each of those things, starting with maybe some kind of a story or something about him that just it exemplifies everything we think of as being the West of that time.
Well, I'm trying to think of really the best example here, and there's just he has such a big life that it's hard to just pull one thing out. I think one of the things that you really don't think of with regard to the West is people as family figures, and Granville. Part of what I think makes our book very, very interesting is that here's a man who has two very long marriages, one to a Shoshone woman, and then another later one after Aubani's death. He marries a white school teacher. And these marriages are long, but they're also, especially the first one, is complex, and he considers leaving his wife, and eventually, after her death, he abandons his children. So in some ways, he's a good father, and in some ways, he's a caring husband, but not fully. Mm-hmm. And because he left so many records, we have an unusual opportunity as historians to know what he was thinking at some points in his life.
Yeah.
Now, he starts that first marriage. He's in the last vestiges of the Mountain Man era. So he is a trader, something of a fur trader. They call themselves mountaineers, and he's in southwestern Montana in the late 1850s and up into the early 1860s. And as Carol, because she wrote much of that part of the book, points out, there may have been only 100 white men in what eventually became the state of Montana when Granville and his brother James first arrived in that area. And so it's very much what we call in the book the mixed race frontier. So you do see a very frontier story when he and his brother first come into what eventually is the Montana Territory and then the state of Montana.
Mm-hmm.
But what's different, I think for some, is the fact that his marriage to a Shoshone woman lasts so long. Brother James has other marriages that don't last, and they're also to Native women. And James himself dies in 1872, so Granville outlives his older brother by a significant stretch.
Well, this, I think, again, what makes the story interesting, one of the things that makes the story interesting is that it says something about the complex relationship between the European Americans and the indigenous people that were living there when they got there, and that it was a more complex and nuanced story than often that we get. And clearly, as you say here at this time and in this place, Granville, his brother, the other white men that were there had relations with Indian women. And as you said, Granville married the Shoshone woman, and they were together 25 years. They had 11 children. But it seems that still people were a little bit conflicted about relations between Indian women and white men, and there were some questions, certainly questions about, well, what exactly were the status of these children and how did people feel about that?
Oh, yes.
Right. And I think that they lived a more comfortable life out on the plains, when he moved to the cattle region in the 1880s. I think that that was, I think that there were always tensions between European Americans and mixed race people, even in that part of Montana. But I think that there were more opportunities for his children there than if he had remained, he'd been living in Helena just prior to that. And I don't think that that was a very comfortable place for the mixed race children.
And this dynamic of the emergence of sort of the domination of society and social values by, white society, the racial dynamics of the time, are fascinating, and it's something that Carol and I are able to focus on. And we spent, Carol and I were on the faculty at Utah State University for a combined 51 years, 25 years for Carol, 26 for me. And then we moved here to Arkansas State, and some of what we look at here is civil rights and race relations and dynamics of the American South. But interestingly enough, as we finished up this book, some of those thoughts about the hegemony of white society is also in play as it emerges in the West out of this earlier era where there's this intermixing of people. Eventually, we see more of a standard story emerge. And Granville himself, when he abandons his children after Albany dies, we say it very directly in the book, he crosses back over the race line and marries a white woman. And in some ways is consciously changing his social status to fit in more in the mainstream. Even though he's a prominent figure in his time and in his place, he seems very willing and very comfortable to be identified now very much as a white male leader.
Yeah. And they also were married for a long time, but they never had any children.
That's right. And so we're convinced that it's because Belle, his second wife, was not capable, because obviously Granville had been able to produce numerous children with Albany. And so we figured that that's part of the story. We did find a letter he wrote. It's one of the somewhat humorous, bragging about his birth control techniques. And he wrote it to another man in Minneapolis. He wrote it 9 months before the birth of their 10th child. So he's a man of science and learning and books, but sometimes he doesn't seem to quite understand that his confidence in what he considers birth control isn't playing out too well.
Our guests this morning in this hour of Focus 580, Clyde Milner and Carol O'Connor, they're professors of history at Arkansas State University, co-editors of the Oxford History of the American West, and also co-authors of a recently published biography of Granville Stewart. The title of the book is As Big as the West. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And questions, certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. He was born in Virginia, 1834. Then his family moved out to the Midwest. I guess we can make some partial claim because for a short period of time they lived in Illinois.
That's correct.
Before going on to Iowa.
Yeah, that's correct. he really is an Iowa farm boy. His boyhood years, his formative years are in Iowa, his school days. But then at age 17, he goes out to California, to the California Gold Rush. And that's an important episode in his young malehood. But then, by 1857, he's entered what will be known as Montana.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the, or I want to give you an opportunity to talk about the relationship between the brothers, the two brothers, Granville and James. How close were they, and how important was that relationship?
Oh, they were very close, and I think Granville loved James more than he loved any other human on the face of this earth. He was 2 years younger than James. He went to school at a very young age because he didn't want to be apart from his older brother, and there are even stories of him holding on to James's coattails and getting to school by just being pulled over the ice by James. So you know, they're close when they're young. They're close when they head off to California in 1852. At that point, James is 20 and Granville's 17, about to turn 18. So they have this whole adventure in California together. And actually the way they wind up in Montana is because Granville became seriously ill as they were heading back to Iowa. And, it's kind of a complex story, but Montana was the place where the weather could be counted on to be reasonably okay. So they have this whole adventure together. They even had a diary that they shared, where first one brother would write the notations for a week or so, and then the other brother would pitch in. And so, you know, it's a kind of relationship where they one brother would end the other brother's sentences almost. Mm. A lot of people think that James was the brother that was, really the heroic type. And certainly he was very restless. I think he was the person who was more eager to go off and use his gun in situations. Granville was a little bit more scholarly and, hung back a little bit more. They're going to kind of switch relationships a little bit because James winds up bankrupt in the late 1860s, and he goes off to serve as the key trader at a fort in central Montana, and at that point, Granville really has to assume control of the family holdings, and in many ways, he starts to take the dominant role in the family at that point.
Yeah, in fact, Carol uncovered, I think, an important part of the story, because there is this question: why does Granville stay with Albany and with the kids? He does write some letters. A kind of cruel humor about, oh, I ought to drown this outfit, I ought to get rid of these kids, and, it's holding me back. But he does stay, and he stays until Albany dies after the death of the 11th child. But we think the critical decision to stay with Albany and the kids is because James dies, and Granville has been taking care of two of James's sons, mixed race, Bob and Dick, and these are the nephews. And in some ways, because of his sense of responsibility towards his brother after the very close, beloved brother dies, he's going to care for these nephews, and that means he's going to stay with Albany and his own children. And that does seem to be an important family dynamic that comes out from the close relationship with the brother.
Yeah. This man, I'm continually impressed by the depth and breadth of this man. He was interested in writing and was certainly a capable writer. Books and reading were important to him. In your book, you have some sketches that mm-hmm. he did, so he certainly had some talent as an artist. What sort of education did he have, and where did these, particularly these strong feelings about reading and writing come from?
Oh, nice question. He has a schoolboy education in Iowa. His brother James has a bit more advanced education and even spent some time with a doctor in Iowa City and learned some medical practice. But we think it emerges from his parents. The father seems to have kept a diary that burned up in the house back in Iowa in the 1850s. But it's not that he has a lot of formal education. He does it pretty much himself. Now, he writes about how, you know, school is important and it inspires him. But he's a self-made man in these terms. His commitment to books, to learning languages, he does publish the first Shoshone English Dictionary, he does publish the first book about Montana, he does science reporting back to the Smithsonian. He is an incessant writer. He wrote thousands and thousands of letters, and he made copies. And because of that, we get all these details about his life that is not typical for a figure out in the American West in the 19th century, particularly in this remote area like Montana. So that's an incredible windfall for us to have over 7,000 of his personal letters that we could read because he kept them in letterpress volumes. So there is an incredible sort of intellectual energy to him that does amaze us. He would write letters back to Winchester and Colt and tell them how to improve their guns. I mean, he's fascinated with guns. He's an expert marksman, and he has quite a gun collection as well as an extensive library of some 3,000 books by the time he's out on the Central Range at the DHS Ranch.
Well, I'm interested in the interest in guns, and I suppose today maybe people find that problematic. I guess you have to consider the fact that guns at the time were important tools of not only self-defense but also survival. So, you know, the fact that someone would be interested in guns and want to make sure that their guns would serve them and would be ready and would do what they were supposed to do when they would be needed, you know, maybe that certainly should not be surprising.
Well, yeah, but I will say that his love of guns starts in Iowa, hunting with his father, and there is a certain connection to the father in terms of guns and using guns and becoming part of, as we state in the book, the gun culture of the time. Then, of course, the Overland Trails, you know, heading out to California. People packed small arsenals going across the Overland Trails, and gunshot accidents were a major cause of death for overlanders. Mm-hmm. You know, pulling a loaded gun off a wagon was one way to kill yourself heading west. James and Granville aren't that dumb with guns, but it's just an insight into, yes, there's quite a gun culture at the time. And then once he's out on the cattle range, he gets out there very early in 1880, and you could say it is nearly a range war against indigenous peoples and mixed-race peoples who still have a purpose to try to use that range, but Granville and his investors want it to be a cattle range. And so one of his interests is making the range safe for cattle, and that means getting rid of the Indians. Now, this is, of course, ironic because he has a family that's half Shoshone, but that's not how he's seeing the world when he's out on the cattle range trying to be a major cattleman. And he will run the largest cattle herd of the time, some 20,000 head of cattle at its height. Mm.
I do want to mention one thing. There's a point when Granville is living in the first mining camp in Montana that made it big, Bannock, and he said that people had to start going armed all the time because there were so many fights. And that was a new thing. So they didn't always walk around with pistols and rifles, you know. He remarked on it.
Yeah. Well, and I guess it was something, I'm not sure why it occurs to me at this point. Maybe it's my thought about the association of guns, violence, and drinking. But he didn't drink.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. We think he occasionally had a drink. In his older age, he and his second wife made quite a thing about saying that he didn't drink. But my guess is once in a while to celebrate, he certainly did. But he was not part of that alcoholic nation that was so much typical of Jacksonian America. And in some ways, this frontier West is an extension of Jacksonian America. And you get out in mining camps, and they certainly see this in California. One of the things that people did was they drank. That was their pastime. That was one of their amusements. And so, yeah, the consumption of alcohol is rather significant. But, yes, both he and James avoid consuming alcohol.
Let me just introduce again for anybody who might have tuned in our guests for this hour, Clyde Milner and Carol O'Connor. They're professors of history at Arkansas State University. They're co-editors of the Oxford History of the American West, and they are the co-authors of a recently published biography of an important figure in the West, certainly someone who figures important in the history of Montana, a man named Granville Stewart. The book is titled As Big as the West, published by the Oxford University Press. Stewart lived between 1834 and 1918, and we're talking about him this morning, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about him and relations at the time between white people and Indians. And this is something that would have been, for a lot of his life, he would have lived alongside Native people, and there still were Indians living in Iowa at the time in the late 1830s when he was living there, and then, of course, in California and Montana. And the relations were complicated. Can you talk some more about, to the extent that you can say something about what he thought about Native people?
He seems very selective and specific in his attitudes. There are some Native peoples for whom he has a positive opinion. Not surprisingly, Shoshones are high on his list because he marries a Shoshone woman, and he even writes that of all the Native women, the Shoshone are the most beautiful. Well, his wife is Shoshone, so he's saying something rather complimentary about her. When he's out in California, the Maidu, who are the Natives up in the Sierra Nevada, as a young man, he's very impressed with them. He's particularly impressed that they wear practically no clothes. So he says he feels like he's walked into the Garden of Eden. and, you know, for an Iowa farm boy, this is probably a pretty dramatic change, even though back in Iowa there had been some interaction with what, you know, generally are called Fox Indians. And he had some knowledge of Native peoples from those days, but not as direct and immediate as what happens in California, and nothing like what's going to happen out in Montana. Now, so, you know, he can say some positive things, but there are certain Indian groups he just hates, he has a rage about, most specifically the Crows. And the reason for that is that James went out on an expedition along the Yellowstone River looking for gold. This is what these guys do. And there was an attack by Crow Indians, not surprisingly, because these prospectors are on Crow land. as far as Granville's concerned, the Crow are despicable and should be exterminated. He reminds us of Andrew Jackson in terms of how Jackson could despise lots of Indian people, but then at times say, you know, very warm things about specific Indians. Granville has that kind of character. He also has mixed feelings about Métis people, so mixed race, French Canadian, Crees. They're very prominent in central Montana, And he's, you know, but he knows a figure like Johnny Grant, who's very important back in his earlier days in Montana, his first days in Montana. But he'll, you know, he sees mixed race people as a threat to the cattle range because he's afraid they're going to kill cattle and, you know, steal them or steal horses. And we start seeing this kind of attitude, and yet he has a mixed race family. It's Shoshone, half Shoshone children, but yeah, there is this interesting contradiction. But you can see appreciation of some Native peoples, and then you can see rage against others, particularly if he thought they were a threat to his interests.
And, of course, James has a lot of contact with the Natives when he's at Fort Browning in central Montana. And his few years there, I think, are at a really significant turning point for American, that is, you know, U.S. government, Native American relations. And at that fort, they're really inundated with Lakota or Sioux who've come by and are demanding rations, but those rations actually were set up for the members of some other tribes. And so, you know, James is trying to kind of keep a lid on the situation there. But it's a desperate time because the buffalo are hard to find. The Indians, some of them are starving, and there are epidemics as well. So it's a very grim and sad time.
But once he's on the cattle range, he wants all threat of American Indians using that same range removed. He wants the Army to do it. He wants the federal government to do it when he thinks they aren't being effective. He talks about raising a private army to try to get rid of the Indians. Now, then he realizes how expensive that would be. And so, I mean, it's sort of strange because it's almost a parallel to some buyouts and things today. He says, oops, we can't afford to do this. So we still want the federal government to do it, and there are lots of letters and petitions and demands that, you know, these Indians have to be kept off our range. Well, it's, you know, it is the open range. Yes, it's being developed for big-time cattle interests, but it is that transition from when it had been buffalo range and when it had been a place much more utilized by Native Americans. So he is an interesting part of a very important story in the shift of just the use of the land in the American West, going from buffalo to cattle.
Mm-hmm. At this time and in this place, I guess wouldn't be surprised that cattle rustling was a problem, and other, of course, there would have been other kinds of lawlessness, and maybe not much in the way of formal institutionalized law enforcement. Tell us about his involvement as a vigilante and what you, I think, in the book, one point referred to as "quote unquote" popular justice. How did people deal with the lack of organized law enforcement?
Well, you know, it's not that the law enforcement is that absent. His ranch is 2 miles from a major fort, Fort McGinnis. There are 500 soldiers there. If there's any threat of Indians stealing cattle or stealing horses, there are soldiers around. Yes, there will be Indians stealing cattle, but more prominently horses. And in fact, it's not rustling that's so much an issue. It's some cattle killing and then horse stealing. And his greatest rage is against Indians, but there is, you know, there's a kind of federal order not in place to help with some of that. And it's, you know, his great vigilante episodes in the mid-1880s, it's 1884, and yes, he will say, and even the territorial governor will claim, that there is no effective law and order out there in the Central Range, and so these, you know, citizens had to take justice into their own hands. Well, it's not clear that things are that disorderly or that there's that much horse stealing going on when we look closely at his letters. But it seems as though, you know, the supposed horse thieves that his vigilantes go after, and they're known as Stuart Stranglers, are the easier target. Trying to take on American Indians that they complain about constantly, like the Crows, for stealing horses. No, there's a price to pay with that. But these smaller groups that may or may not really be horse thieves, and what they'll do is find them in wood yards along these men camped along the Missouri River, in that area known as the Missouri Breaks to some people, you know, they become the target. And you know, it's something that after the fact we think he amplifies the horse stealing issue. It does become a very famous episode, though, and some 18 men are killed, some of them hanged, by his vigilantes. He is present for some of this. He is not present for perhaps the most dramatic killing by his vigilantes, and that's when his nephew, Dixie Burr, is killed by Stuart Stranglers. And that is the son of Albany's sister, who is also half Shoshone, and whose father was a rather well-known pioneer in Montana who'd left the sister and was back in Washington, D.C. But it is quite a story that Granville's vigilantes killed his nephew, and Granville seemed quite willing to have them do it, even though Dixie Burr had asked for work at the ranch just about 6 months earlier, and Granville wrote a friendly letter saying, gee, sorry, there's no work here. Good luck to you. And then several months later, Dixie's at the wrong end of the rope with the vigilantes.
He, after doing all these things that we talked about, being involved in mining, other kinds of business, in cattle ranching, and so forth, he got involved in politics. And later, maybe we can talk about how it is that he later became a U.S. ambassador.
Yeah,
in South America. But before that, he was involved in more, say, local politics. What was his interest in politics?
Well, he is a community developer. He starts off in the Deer Lodge Valley, and eventually there is the community of Deer Lodge, and he wants to see it prosper and grow, as does James. They've got real estate investments. If you know, they own town lots. He is committed to schools. He gets involved with the school board. He gets involved with community and what we now call county development. He will serve in the territorial legislature. He moves up, you could say, the sort of ranks of political involvement. Now, he is a Jacksonian Democrat. His father was apparently very much pro-Jackson in a time when Jackson was alive, and then sort of in the aftermath of Jackson's presidency and prominence. And Granville is, you know, it's interesting because he hates formal religion. He's a free thinker, but he's very dedicated to the Democratic Party and very active and very prominent. And that connection is going to serve him well when he can't, when his days on the cattle range are over. There's really a failure out there in terms of his efforts with being superintendent of the large ranch. And he has to fall back really on his political connections to get work. So he'll be the first state land agent in Montana. And that makes him more entwined with the whole Democratic machinery. But then, you know, he's been there in Montana since before the pioneers, as he says in his memoir. So he knows people, and it's some of those friends who helped set him up to become the U.S. minister to Paraguay and Uruguay. And he goes down there during a Democratic administration, of course, Grover Cleveland administration, in 1894. So it is party politics, but it's also being one of the founders and being involved early on and rising up and having a certain prominence.
He, as you mentioned, he had two wives. His first wife, Albany, was a Shoshone woman, and they lived together for 25 years, had 11 children, and were together until she died. Then later, he married a white woman, Isabel, and they were also married for a long time and never had any children. How did he meet her? Tell us about Isabel.
Well, she actually was a teacher for his kids at the ranch, and she also she has something of a Midwestern connection in that she actually did attend school at one point at what's currently Valparaiso University in Indiana. That's just a kind of side point there. She's a lot younger than he is. She's, I think it's 29 years younger than he is. And she had taught the kids at the ranch and then left and took another job elsewhere. And after Bonnie's death, Granville apparently looks her up. And before long, they're something of an item. Although they didn't get married until a little more than a year after Albani's death. It's like 15 months after she died that they got married. It's interesting. Now there's quite a contrast between the two marriages in that Belle obviously wrote Granville a lot of letters. I mean, she would go off and try to raise some funds for the couple, much as he did. And while they were apart, they wrote to one another. And then there are a lot of cute little things that they'll say to each other. They tried to have children. That's quite clear from early on.
Cute's a nice way to put it, yes. It's very clear in the letters that they're eager to have children, and he's not happy if she's away from him because he wishes she was there. There's quite a romance and there's quite a physical attraction, but yeah, she is a much younger woman, and he's rather proud of himself for marrying this young woman. Belle is how he refers to her and how she's known. And Belle, in the overall knowledge about Granville, not much has been done with Belle that's positive. There's always been the assumption that she's something of the evil stepmother who came in, and she's the reason that he abandoned the kids. And certainly she's an aspect of that, although, it's Granville's call to get rid of his children after the marriage. He plays a key part in that, beyond doubt. But because we have so much material on Belle, I think, get to appreciate her situation with him. And ultimately, his surviving children start to appreciate her because she's dealing with older, grumpy Granville and is very loyal to him and stays with him until he dies in 1918. She's actually married to him longer than Albani was. And she does a lot of things. Carol was mentioning it. She goes out and tries to sell mining stock and tries to do other things that might help their income. They're desperate for money. The one thing that does work in their advanced years is she opens a beauty parlor, and she runs a beauty parlor for 3 years. There was no Social Security, and in some ways he was relying as much on his young wife to make ends meet as on his own abilities and connections.
We are coming into about our last 10 minutes on the program here. Let me, again, for people who might have tuned in, introduce our guests, Clyde Milner and Carol O'Connor. They are professors of history at Arkansas State University, co-editors of the Oxford History of the American West, and they're also the co-authors of a book published by Oxford University Press that's a biography of this man that we're talking about here, Granville Stuart. The title of their book is As Big as the West. It's published by the Oxford University Press, and as they explained at the beginning of the program, before going there to Arkansas, where they are now, they taught for a number of years. And was it Utah State?
Yes, Utah State in Logan, Utah.
All right. I've been to Logan.
Good. You may have met Lee Austin, our old friend at KUSU.
It was a long time ago. In a past life, but I remember it as being a very pretty town. Here being a Midwesterner, you're not much used to mountains, and I guess the thing I remember about Logan is walking down the main street of town and sort of looking to one side and looking to the other side, and there being mountains.
Yes.
Very picturesque.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah,
it's indeed.
A bit like Jackson Hole with more people, but yes. It's a beautiful Rocky Mountain Valley, there's no question about it. It's spectacular.
Yeah.
But Arkansas has its attractions too. It has the Ozarks.
Well, I will defend forever the flatlands here. I'm a flatlander, so.
Oh, we got flatlands here too. We're right on the edge of the Arkansas Delta. We can get flat.
Well,
stretching right to Memphis from where we are, it gets real flat. But sure, no, I know what you're saying.
I think
Grandma was in those flatlands when he was around Princeton, Illinois. So.
Another interesting details of this man's life, given that he had lived the kind of life that we talked about, being a rancher and living in the West and being ready with a gun and doing all these things. Maybe some people might be surprised to hear that at the end of his life, he was a librarian. He was the librarian.
The ironies are just fabulous with this. Well, of course, you know, he loved books. He collected books. He wrote books. He's a bookman. And he comes back from South America. There's no social security. There's no security. He needs a job. And he flails around for a while until finally, again, through political connections, he becomes head librarian in Butte, Montana. Now, he had lived in Montevideo, Uruguay, as the U.S. minister. Gorgeous city on the River Plate, one of the beautiful cities of the Americas, and with a population far larger than the entire state of Montana. He comes back to what's the largest industrial mining city in the Americas. It has huge air pollution. It's difficult sometimes at high noon to even see across the street when they were smelting or refining ores in Butte. And Granville hates the Irish. And it is the highest percentage population of Irish residents of any community in the United States, more than Boston or Chicago or San Francisco. There are all these Irish miners. They're heavily Irish Catholic. He hates formal religion. They tend to be young. He's old. He's the old pioneer in the midst of industrial America running a library. He's really out of place in some ways. But he does settle in, and eventually he has a feud with a socialist mayor because he's a Democrat, and the Socialist Party starts to run the city government, and that socialist mayor eventually gets him removed as librarian. So he does about 10 years as a librarian. It's true. It's quite a story. Yeah. And one of the dramas of it is the library burns down shortly after he takes over, and he has to see the library rebuilt and reopened and all that. And, you know, it's somewhat dramatic as library stories go, but it is his last formal job. Yep, he's a librarian. Yeah.
And this it certainly ties in with his, as you say, with his interest in books and writing, and also with his interest in history, because one of the things that he was really interested in doing was to try to preserve the history of Montana.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. We don't play it up maybe as much as we should in the book, but they founded the Montana Historical Society in 1865. I mean, the place became a territory in 1864.
Right.
Granville and James were among the organizers of the Montana Historical Society.
So 1 year on, they've got a historical society.
Right.
It is pretty amazing.
And it's also here, we've talked about, he wrote this account of a piece of his life, at least, this book, 40 Years on the Frontier. And what's, I think, striking about this book is, I think that that this is true, that it's actually still in print.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it has never been out of print. It still does rather well. It was published posthumously. He died in 18. It came out in 1925. But you know, for people who read about the West, who care about Western memoirs, it's one of the better-known extensive memoirs about life in the West. And in some ways, it's how we know Granville Stewart. It's because of his own presentation of his story through this memoir. It's an important book and a well-known book. But the better-known memoir is written by his son-in-law, Teddy Blue Abbott, who was a Texas cowboy and married one of his daughters, half-Shoshone daughter, Mary Stuart Abbott, and Teddy Blue wrote We Pointed Them North, which for many people is the best memoir of cowboy life ever done. It came out in the 1930s. And in Teddy Blue's memoir, he is full of praise for Granville Stuart, his father-in-law, and says, Granville Stuart was the history of Montana. So there was an interesting connection between two very, very well-known memoirs of the American West, Granville's own 40 Years on the Frontier and then Teddy Blue Abbott's We Pointed Them North.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked earlier about the fact that he was a great reader and also writer, that he wrote many, many letters and, interestingly enough, kept copies. So that sounds like that's the act of someone who thinks that he's doing something important, or at least wants the record of what he had done, what his life was, preserved,
yeah.
if not just for himself, then for posterity. Do you think that he was someone who actually who indeed had that sort of a feeling that there was something there that was that he wanted to remain after he was gone?
Oh, absolutely. You are correct.
Right. He would be pleased to know that we are talking about him this morning.
Yeah. And, you know, that's what makes biography its own peculiar subset of historical scholarship, because it's not fair to call Granville representative of people in the West. You know, the typical Western male of that time didn't have letterpress books and keep 7,000 copies of personal letters and then lots of diaries and ledgers and so forth. But what he is a very full and interesting life that cuts across a lot of Western history. So he's fascinating, but you can't claim he's representative. And full-scale biographies rarely are. They're distinctive. They're interesting, full life, you know, worth examining on their own terms, but also because of the historical setting in which the life was lived.
Mm. Well, we're going to have to stop here, but certainly for people who would like to read more about Granville Stuart, you can go and look for the book that we've talked about. The title is As Big as the West, The Pioneer Life of Granville Stuart. It is published by the Oxford University Press by our guests Clyde Milner and Carol O'Connor. They're both professors of history at Arkansas State University and co-editors of the Oxford History of the American West. And Professor O'Connor, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Professor Milner, thank you.
Yeah, it was great to talk, and we really appreciate this.
All right, you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. We first broadcast the show December 17th of last year. A lot of our past interviews, also interviews from Focus 580, all of our local production is available on our website. You can listen anytime you're ready. It's will.illinois.edu.
WILL programs are made possible with support from the Art Mart in Lincoln Square, Urbana. The Art Mart's deli, grocery, and bakery feature premium foods and ingredients for cooking and entertaining, including Reuben's chocolates. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio.
And we'll take our customary break here so we can bring you an update on the markets and news. Then we'll be back with another Focus 580 archive program, so we hope you'll stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists. More information is at agrigold.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at mid-session, prices are, as they have been for much of the week, moving in a relatively narrow trading range in a relatively subdued marketplace. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. In Kansas City, May wheat now trading 5.55 and a quarter, up a quarter. July, 5.66 and a quarter, up a quarter. September, 5.77, up a quarter. At the Chicago Board of Trade, May wheat at 5.09, up one. July, 5.21 and three quarters, up one. September, up one as well, 5.47 and a quarter is the tick there. May corn, 3.89 and a quarter, up three and a half. July, 3.99 and three quarters, up three and a half. December, 4.21, up three and a half. March of 2010, 4.33, up three and a quarter. May crude oil, 53.40, up 63 cents. The April ethanol contract at 1.59 is up 1 cent. April Arbob at 150 and one-tenth is up 6 tenths. May beans, 948 and a half, down 2 and a half. July, 944 and a quarter, down 1 3/4. August, 926 and 3/4, down 1/4. November, 882 and a quarter, up 2 1/4. May soybean meal, 292.10, down 220. May soybean oil, 33.59, up 22.